This episode of Paratopia is dedicated to crop circle research pioneer Pat Delgado. Rest in peace, Pat, and thank you.
In a new age world filled with delusions and wish fulfillment by morons in need of attention, renowned experiencers of high strangeness and podcasters Jeffrey Ritzman and Jeremy Vaney received invitations to a tropical paradise getaway called Paratopia. Little did they know, it was the same type of new age spiritual retreat they've been avoiding all their lives.
Don't be shy.
Crop circles are all about love.
Even the ones made by Team Satan.
Come on, you can shake it.
Yeah.
Man, those hedgehogs running in a circle sure know their Mayan geometry.
Anything goes in Paratopia. And welcome.
Jeff, we're only 3 episodes into season 2 of Paratopia, and we're just getting better and better, and I didn't think that was possible, frankly. I thought we might have peaked somewhere around season 1, but no. In fact, we came out strong with Graham Hancock, then we had a little fun with the Ghosts of Gettysburg tour, and now we're talking to the one, the only...
Colin Andrews.
That's right. And I should apologize in advance in case we don't get this worked out. There was some sort of humming noise that was on the phone that I have tried to take out 6 ways from Sunday, and I can't seem to take it out without affecting the quality of our vocals. And then when I finesse those, the sound comes right back, so it's as if I never took the sound out at all. So Jeff will try to fiddle with it a little bit, and if not, then you'll just have to... let your ears get used to it, and as you will find out during the episode, it was a night of strange electronic stuff and energy in the
air.
Holy
crap.
Yeah, yes. This is arguably the best episode of Paratopia, at least.
You will ever hear.
Yeah, we might have peaked right now.
This might be it, yeah. Yeah, I think this is it. Well, I mean, everybody knows Colin Andrews is the crop circle guy. He is the man who coined the whole term crop circle. So we have been trying to get him on since, I believe, August. And he has just been mad busy. He did the X conference, which we I missed, but Jeremy and everyone else saw. But I got the DVD and watched that. And I was completely smoked and blown away by his presentation there. And immediately said, we've got to get him on the show. We've got to talk to this man. And after he got done all of his busy stuff, he was able to come on. And we talked to him last night. And I'm still, to be honest with you, slack-jawed at the whole discussion. It is, like Jeremy said, it is the best show we've ever done. And that doesn't mean to marginalize any of our other guests. I think they've all been great. But Colin is somebody who's been in this ever since I can remember, you know, being interested in ufology and all that. He's the guy you've always seen in every serious, you know, discussion of the crop circle phenomena. And, you know, and he's got a lot to say and a lot of stuff that you might be rather surprised at, considering what Jeremy said, which was most people dismiss crop circles and, you know.
Yeah, I mean, that's just it. You take something like crop circles – and you go, that's either man-made or, as he said, you know, maybe some of the smaller ones were real, the little just circles. But all of the other stuff is man-made. And it turns out that doesn't even matter.
Yeah.
Not that it's even true. It's not true. But
right.
It doesn't even matter. It's still the phenomenon. And the phenomenon is the phenomenon. And it is something enigmatic. And it is as deeply complicated as we have been arguing the UFO situation is.
Yes.
And by that I mean it's not a nuts and bolts here, there, right, wrong, hoax, not hoax situation. It's a tapestry of consciousness working itself out in myriad ways, a la George Hansen. A la
it's back to the same old thing of more complex and far more bizarre than you would imagine it to be. I mean, far more bizarre than you could imagine it to be, which is part of, you know, what we talked to him about. I really hope that the discussion translates to listeners that you actually feel something while this is going on. I'm going to leave it at that.
Yeah.
Before we get to this, though, I want to give Colin his plugs here for his latest two books, Government Circles and The Complete Idiot's Guide to 2012. The first one is available from his website, which is www.colinandrews.net. And anyone who's interested in the crop circle debate and all of this history will like to know that his first book ever written on the subject, which he co-authored with the man we're dedicating tonight's episode to, which is Pat Delgado, called Circular Evidence, which is now long since out of print, can be downloaded as an ebook directly from Colin's website. And I would encourage everybody to do both of those, to read both of those. And Government Circles, which was predominantly, I think, what he focused on at the X conference, which was calling people like Nick Pope to task on the government's position over there in the UK on crop circles. So The Complete Idiot's Guide to 2012, I haven't got a chance to go through that yet, but Colin did say
at the idiot end, part down. I know that.
Well, yeah, I've got the idiot parts squarely in my corner. But the complete idiot, I might add. But one of the things that Colin said about 2012 at the X conference was that everyone is doom and gloom. Everyone is polar ice cap, you know, flying all over the planet. Next ice age, earthquakes, fire from the sky, dogs and cats living together.
John Cusack running a limousine through a burning building to get away from other burning buildings.
Right. And one of the things Colin says that does somewhat apply to what he's going to talk about with us tonight, which is if that's the way that everyone on this planet thinks about 2012, then that is indeed what might happen. So at any rate, you can go to colinandrews.net and check out all of his DVDs, books, and whatnot. But those three he wanted me to mention, especially the ebook of Circular Evidence, which you cannot get anywhere else.
Colin Andrews.
Well, Colin, thanks for coming on Paratopia tonight with us.
That's my pleasure.
We've been dying to have you on for a very long time, and you're a very busy man, and I appreciate the time you're taking with us. And I did, before we even get started with questions, I wanted to send my condolence to you on the loss of your friend Pat Delgado.
Yes.
Thank you.
This episode of Paratopia is dedicated to Mr. Delgado and all the work that he did with you. So this is a question I'm sure you get asked about a million times every interview that you do. But how did you first get involved in doing any kind of crop circle research at all? Because this was a new wrinkle on the field many years ago, and you were the first man I ever saw associated with it routinely.
Right. Well, I was really kind of it was a regular day in July 1983 as a senior official at that time in regional government in central southern England, about 40 miles from Stonehenge. I was driving to a meeting, a regular meeting, on the high ground, and I just really casually happened to look to my left down into a wheat field, which was in a valley below the level that the highway was on, and I saw a set of five circles forming a cross, and that really was the beginning. I had not heard of them before, seen anything about them in the media or anything else, and I stopped my vehicle and I had a look at from this hill down into the wheat field. I couldn't see any tracks there, and of course immediately started to ask questions of myself. You know, how did these get there? And I walked down into the right down this very steep embankment. It took me probably 20 minutes actually to get into the field, and being late for my meeting, of course. And as I made my way out into the field, I was then, of course, on flat ground, level ground, and it was more difficult to actually see where these circles were until I came across the very first one. And I walked into the first one, which was about 12 feet in diameter, flattened to the ground, swirled around. And again, I can tell you now, and you know, as I have said many times since, that whatever we see and hear about the circles in the media, and for the last nearly 30 years now, I can assure you that that first one for me in July 83 had no tracks to it whatsoever. The only track was my own. I stood there in amazement at what I was looking at, and I could hear, I've always, you know, can always remember this very clearly, hearing a kind of popping sound, kind of a click, 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 click kind of sound. And I stood there and watched what was causing this, and it was really the heads of the plants, which had been flat to the ground and were flat to the ground, were separating and kind of lifting back up. That as they separated, they would click from leaving contact with the one plant adjacent to it. And this was happening right across the profile of the circle. So this gave me the immediate impression that this had only just happened, or certainly at a short time before. So that was really it, Jeff. That was the very beginning. And the evening of that day, I was in a privileged position. I was a major civil emergency planning officer for Test Valley, which is the central southern England area. And, you know, I had access, easy access to the military and to the police and other departments. And I started making inquiries and soon realized that this was not new. Farmers in that area, indeed farmers of that field, knew these circles going back many years. So that was the beginning.
Wow. Well, I mean, I think what a lot of people have heard, at least, you know, at least way back when stateside, we heard a lot of accounts talking about no tracks in or out, just like you were saying about your first encounter with these things, blown out nodes of the stalks of whatever plant that you know, happened in what was rye or rape field or whatever, a weaved lay down pattern underneath and swirled one way on top, another way underneath, all sorts of really weird things that didn't necessarily point to these being man-made. As your own research progressed in this, as the years went by, more and more became man-made, this kind of facilitated man-made ones popping up here and there.
Yeah.
But those initial ones that held these very distinct characteristics, do they still occur these days? And if they do, in what frequency do you find that they occur still?
It's a great question. I don't very often get asked that, but it's a very important question because one question really off the back of the other is, if they're still appearing, why don't we hear so much about them? And as you have rightly put it, that, you know, what are the numbers if they are? Well, as far as I know, and, you know, I still head back to England and indeed travel to other parts of the world where these circles are reported. I would say this, that the numbers that are researched are less of the original kind of simple circle with the features that you have described, plus some more that we maybe get to in the program. They are less, and I think the reason for that is that the more complex patterns speak to perhaps communication, but complexity and beauty attracts the researchers, attracts the public, and and attracts the pilots who are flying over that area, that very hot area of central southern England. I don't mean hot as in temperature, but
right.
You know, it's an area where a lot of this activity occurs. And so the simple circles, I've been in aircraft with pilots that will tend to go over them and say, well, do you want this one? Well, yes, we want all of them. I mean, it's important to record everything that's there. Hoaxing as well, it's important to get it all. I think the answer is, Jeff, that yes, they are, as far as I can see, because I have, you know, each year have have seen some and researched some of the simple ones, but we're not zigzagging those aircraft in grid patterns that we used to across the whole of that area. So there are many, I'm sure, that are missed. Whereas initially, in those early days, in the mid-80s and early 90s, it was relatively new, and it was newish to a lot of the farmers, not some, because they'd had them for many years. But this, as this phenomenon was exploding outwards, it was new to many, many farmers, and they were reporting them because they were, in many cases, excited to find them and would report them to Pat and myself and Busty Taylor and Terence Meaden initially. But that excitement has faded somewhat as the years have passed. In fact, it has turned in some cases to anger that the farmers have had enough. So the whole scene has shifted, but the brief answer, that is actually a long answer, but the brief answer is, yes, I'm sure they're there. In most countries, they're still there, but they're not reported in those numbers, and so therefore we see less of them as far as it comes to the media.
In the sense of the genuine unknowns that have been cataloged by you, I always go back to that classic one that we first saw that was the really, really elongated one, later appeared on a Led Zeppelin album cover. I mean, this is probably one of the more famous ones. Was that one in and of itself considered an unknown, or was that traced back to being man-made?
It was never traced back to being man-made. It never has been. There are complex designs. I'm sure we'll get to this in our discussion. But it is not true to say that, and you have not said this, but many do, that the simple circles are real unknowns and the complex ones are not. It's not a true statement. There are many very complex designs that we simply cannot account for. You know, we cannot say with any real level of confidence these are made by people, although many are. And as I say, we'll probably get to that. But the Zeppelin design, which I believe I was certainly one of the first dozen or so people into, a German television crew, ARD Germany, were flying in central southern England the day that appeared, and were the first to come across it upon it before the farmer himself was aware that it was in his field. So the design certainly once and for all stamped crop circles into the media. The farmer of that field became quite famous himself. The Carsons became quite famous themselves because of that design, and then many that followed. So yes, the time that we spent in it, in looking at the symmetry, the kind of swirl patterning, the analysis that was conducted there, had all the hallmarks of the real thing, and with always leaving a door open that humans are clever beasts and can deceive and sure. do deceive, always ready for the phone to call and say, well, this one we did. So that's always left as an open door for anything that I'll say today. But as far as I know, and if that was 1990, the pattern you're referring to, that's as clean and green as they come.
Wow. Was there ever any assemblage of what that may have meant? Was there any symbols in there? I know I read somewhere on the net some time ago that a gentleman had connected that somehow to weather symbols that were integrated into that circle. Was that true, false? Have you not heard of that? Is that?
Oh, yes. Yes, I've certainly heard of it. Ed Sherwood is the person that put that forward. And he's right that if you look at the meteorological symbols, international symbols, many of those arms and features that come off of the circles and the central axis are related to wind, rain, and weather phenomena used by the Met offices around the world. But having said that, as individual components, they are weather symbols. But as far as reading from one end to the other, like you would going through from A to Z, there's not a cohesive message. You could say that it's a design which shows weather symbols, but not in a cohesive kind of informative way. So I think the fact that it wasn't supported, followed up, by any more than a further two that would lead you to believe that this was the first teaching, you might say, in informing and teaching us about meteorology and perhaps the world, the planet's climate. It didn't take that route. I mean, we have many designs, many family of designs, as I refer to them, you know, of astronomy, astrology, meteorology. There are others that form mathematical equations. So there are many patterns that mean many things. But that one, we had two others within 24 hours that were extremely similar. If you looked at them quickly, you would say they were identical, but actually they weren't. They were very similar. Within a mile of that design, in Eastfield and Alton Barnes, Wiltshire, two more appeared. But that was the end. It suddenly scuttled off. It was like, as I often say, it's like a water droplet under a microscope freezing into a snowflake. And the complexity then just burst out, not only in England, but around the world, into many other intricate and other suggested meanings.
Well, I think that that formation in particular is going to kind of lead into our discussion later about where you've come with this. But I have to ask, in one of your lectures that I recently attended, not too terribly long ago, you were talking about you and Pat in the field investigating a formation of some sort. And Pat was pulled into the center of this thing. And and that it was basically, as you said, all you could do to pull backwards on him, to pull him out of the center of this thing. And I think you had mentioned that it genuinely scared him that this happened. And I immediately, when I heard that, I drew the line to, you know, what people call fairy rings and the things that people like Jacques Vallée talked about as far as, you know, people being pulled into rings and the correlation with myth and all of these kind of things. Or have you seen that type of thing often? I mean, do you get reports of that sort of thing often?
No. It was certainly one of the most bizarre experiences that either of us had. We have had our share, but that stands out as being the most bizarre of them all. And actually, this very year, and the dedication which you've kindly put on this program for Pat, and I will convey this to his family tomorrow, is rather very touching, because Pat and I were in discussion about this very experience that you're referring to this year. Earlier this year, he and I were started to look once again at everything that occurred surrounding the Chesfoot Head event, which is the one that you're referring to. I can maybe go through that step by step in a moment, because sure. It is the center of a number of things that are happening at the moment. You might or may not be aware that on my website, which is just for anybody listening that wants to come in and have a look in detail what we're discussing here, is colinandrews.net. And in there, on the website, you'll see that there's a section referring to Chesfoot Head. Well, Chesfoot Head is a location. In fact, it's the location where I saw the first circle in 83 that I, you know, we started the program with. Opposite that field was where this happened. And there were about, I think it was approximately 10 witnesses to this. It was the most extraordinary thing, where a sound showed up from the east. We all heard it coming. It was a very strange sound, which I cannot really begin to describe. I've referred to it as like an electronic bird. It was like a bird sound, but it was electronic and metallic. And when it reached us, we were stood in a circle just after midnight. There was a surveillance operation, Operation White Crow, was going on at the time. We'd not had any luck on any of the equipment to record anything of any kind at all. That was the whole idea of it. It was ahead of Operation Blackbird, which was the following year, again, a surveillance operation in places where circles appear quite regularly. So we decided to walk away from the equipment and the control room and walk up the hill into a field where there already were two crop circles. They had appeared several days before. And we went in there. It was, of course, dark, just after midnight. We heard this sound coming, and we kind of, you know, clustered together because it really got very close to us. And then it started to behave, and I'm saying behave because that's exactly what it was. Whatever this was knew that we were there because it started to rotate around us. It was like a stereophonic effect of something moving around us, almost like herding us. It was kind of zipping around our heads, and then it stopped in one particular place. And Pat has always said that he felt instinctively as if he was being called to it. In his head, he was being told to go to it. And he did leave us. And everybody you'll see this on the net, you know, they're all of the people there confirm this, as indeed I do. I was there too. And he walked away to this sound, and he began kind of a scooping effect with one hand cupped, and beckoning me to come over to him, to the sound. And as I got to him, and he was kind of cupping his hands across the heads of the plants and kind of pushing, it's hard to just explain this to you, towards my stomach, to my solar plexus, as if he was kind of working on me in some energetic fashion, but I had no idea what it was he was doing. And he kind of gestured that he had done what he felt he was being told to do. And I turned and walked back to the group, expecting Pat to come with me. This sound was still there, but it had moved back a few feet. And I looked at him, and, you know, our eyes, to say this, I think it's important to say this, that the longer you stay in darkness, and we all know this, of course, in your bedroom or anywhere else, your eyes do adjust as much as they can, and you can begin to see form shadowy outlines of one another, people, and so on. And I could see Pat, and we all could. We could all see him there, even though it was a dark field with no street lighting or anything. And he looked terrified. His arms were out straight towards me, and I could see he was in some kind of difficulty. And I went across to him. The others stayed where they were, and Pat was at that point leaning backwards where he should have fallen. He was back, I don't know, 30 degrees or something like that. Huh. But he was not falling, and his arms were out. It was just like, help me, help me. And I held both of his hands, and it started to pull me too. And we both were going backwards into the plants, out of the circle. And I gave one extra tug, and it was just like, well, pulling him away from an energy field of some sort. We both suddenly jolted back to our feet, and we got out of there. We all of us left immediately from the confines of that field. But this would lead me, I'm sorry, this is kind of me doing a lot of talking here.
No, no.
But I should just add why it's become very relevant, is that all of the events that I've described to you, and there are more, we had a severe temperature drop, which was measured, and an atmospheric pressure drop, the barometrical drop on the equipment we had there on the weather station. And it was being looked after by Dr. Maiden, the head of the tornado and storm research in England. And there were many things that happened all within a few minutes during those events that were extremely strange, have never been accounted for. This was written up in a report and sent to the Queen and to Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher, the Chief Scientific Advisor Fisk, to Margaret Thatcher, then the Prime Minister. And I received personal correspondence back, and I'm not allowed, unfortunately, to say who, because I actually posted this correspondence with a lot of other government material on my website a few months ago now, and received instructions from Great Britain to remove it immediately, related to Chesford Head and this event. That's as much as I can say. I was instructed to remove it, or else legal proceedings of a very severe kind would take place. It was to be removed from my presentations, which was the X conference in Washington, D.C. this year, which was removed from that. And I will end this piece by saying, and please don't read me wrong here, I'm not making this a conspiracy when there may not be one, but to say that Pat started a new research on this before I flew over this summer to join Pat Delgado, because he had recorded the same sound, 5.2 kilohertz in the audible frequency, from the trees. That is a sound which was recorded with electronic equipment from the trees that are adjacent to that field at Chesford Head. He and I asked Paul Vige, a close friend and researcher of ours, to join us in July this year to progress this research again, hopefully come to some kind of understanding as to what happened. And then, of course, as you may know, is Pat unfortunately contracted cancer and died. And I then had an email. I was expecting some analysis back from Paul Vige, who had originally carried out the analysis of that sound, which was recorded at Chesford Head. And I had an email expecting his analysis, because he was joining me also in July, to say that his body had been washed up in the English Channel. Unfortunately, Paul also passed. And so therefore, in July, when I got there to try and move this forward a little bit with the sound and the event that you have raised, mm-hmm. Both of my colleagues had passed. And so it has really kind of tended to bring this somewhat again into focus.
Right. Has there been any, I was going to ask about Paul, has there been any outcome of investigation you can tell us about as to what the hell happened?
Well, this really is a very, very delicate area. I have received emails from close friends and a family member of Paul, actually, in the last 2 days. This last week I've had several, but the last 2 days ago, stated that the inquest, which the police and the authorities over there have been working on since Paul went missing and then his body was found, initially they were suggesting that Paul had committed suicide as a result of a domestic situation.
Okay.
And therefore, it is, of course, difficult, because this is extremely painful for his family still.
Of course.
And what has happened now is that the inquest was due, the results of the police investigation were due to have been announced in public and made public last week. Unfortunately, it appears that the family are very unhappy with the results of this inquest, and that I'm as concerned as anybody else, because I knew Paul well, liked him a lot, and there's something here that doesn't seem to tally. But again, I really don't want to raise kind of more
sure.
suspicion than is there, because the indications were really quite strongly that Paul committed suicide. But there are details that can, I think, be spoken about that don't tally, that, you know, he had put back through the letterbox of his home, which is something that tends to be very much, you know, really happens in Europe. Here we have letterboxes, you know, that the mailman puts the mail in. Over
right.
there they don't. They have a slot in their front door, and the mail goes through that onto the floor inside your house. And it is reported, or I guess I should have to say it is alleged, that he pushed his house keys, his door keys, his ignition keys, back through the letterbox into his home with the passwords of his computers. And those passwords that were pushed back through the door were not correct. They did not operate any of his computers. And so it's raising questions, well, why would he do that?
Right.
If indeed this was a suicide. So that really is as much as I think I can I can say about it. It's a tragic, tragic loss.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, on to a completely different matter. One of the things that I brought up on this show a lot, and I guess I should tell you that the majority of what we talk about on here has been the UFO phenomena.
Yeah.
You are our first crop circle investigator to come on, and so I'm glad we got the king of the crop circles to come on first.
Well, thank you very much.
To talk about this. But one of the things I've often said about the UFO phenomena is that I don't relegate it to a nuts and bolts style of a phenomena. It seems to react in turn to thought, to intent, to focus upon it. I've taken to the phrase, you know, the more you give, the more you're going to get.
Yeah.
That sort of thing. And
oh, yeah.
When I heard you speak at the X conference this past time, my jaw was hanging in the air because essentially, you know, to kind of take a step back from it, we heard so much about crop circles in the States initially when they started. And then I remember the point where you said, you know, the majority of these seem to be man-made. And then all of a sudden, it's like the attention seemed to just drop away from them. No one paid them any mind whatsoever in a major way.
Yeah.
But you have found something with not only the unknown crop circles, but also the ones that crop artists are making, including Doug and Dave, who were, you know, these were the two guys who were the first to say that they hoaxed these to fool people. I want you to kind of lay out for the audience what you found that crop circle makers have told you and where you've gone with this, because this is, you know, this has been kind of almost a staple of what I've been saying for a pretty long time about all of this paranormal stuff.
Yeah, well, I think you said it very well. And that's where I have finished up precisely where you laid it out for the UFO. It's all the same thing. I think ultimately it will lead us to a better understand of human consciousness. That is, when we look at all levels of the UFO phenomenon and the crop circle and perhaps many more other fringe and associated phenomenon, why and how I have finished up with this kind of conclusion. It is by very belatedly, and that's not speaking very highly of myself, but very belatedly being prepared to listen without malice to people making crop circles. And this might sound a strange place to start with this, but it really is what led me with my own personal experiences to listen to people making them who are then describing to me the same strange phenomenon they were having, that allowed me to widen this out and to realistically look at the whole thing. And so what I really began to see and then find and then prove was that interaction is indeed what this is all about, that we are engaged first initially by something unusual, whether it's a light in the sky as a UFO or a crop circle on the ground in an unusual symmetry which calls to us in an unusual way. I mean, if we were looking at the field and looking at random haphazard flattened plants, we would say, because our automatic assessment would tell us the mother nature that's inside of us, the animal instinct that is inside of us, that the wind did this. Well, that's nature, and it's nature kind of helping us. But when you look at something precise, symmetrical, that is different, it calls us in a different way. And in that different way, we're engaged. And by engaging thought and possibilities, we begin to manifest a reality, a different reality, a new reality, which is a little bit off the side of Mother Nature as we know her to be, but probably is still, to some degree, Mother Nature. And so I had, maybe to hone in a little bit on this now, I have had my own experiences, which I've never expected anybody else to believe. It's the reason, Jeff, that I'm still talking to you now, nearly 30 years after the circle, you know, the five circles that I discovered in 83, was because I've had one or two very unusual experiences that have said to me, well, what the hell just happened? It's something that just took place right there, knew either what I was thinking, what I was praying for, what I was asking for, in a sincere way, not a, you know, a throwaway line over a pint of beer, but when right. You're stood in the field and you say, which I did in 87, this was in our first book, Circular Evidence, in 89, written by Pat Delgado and myself, and I stood there, I stood there in this ring alone. We had been there with a whole team earlier, and I don't know why I did this. It was just a tranquil, very relaxed setting. It was sunset. I was late back to get this piece of information, which I had forgotten earlier, very close to my home. And I put my hands together. I'm not an over-religious. I don't go to church. I'm not an over-religious person. I believe there's something out there. I believe in some kind of God. I don't know exactly what that is, but, you know, that's where I basically come from in a nutshell. But I put my hands together. And in my head, I closed my eyes and I said, please, God, give me a clue as to what's happening here. And by that, I meant with this phenomenon, which I'd already been looking at for some years. And immediately, and not that I expected it, I never have gotten anything back when I've prayed before.
Right.
But, you know, immediately I got this sound, which was the same sound at Chesfoot Head. With it pulled Pat backwards. The first time it was heard by anybody that I know of, it was the first I ever heard of it, was it when I prayed for a clue, it immediately started. And it was directional. It was about 7 feet in front of my feet. It was down at the base of the plants. I knew where it was. I couldn't see anything. And it got louder and it got louder. And the air began to move. I could feel the oscillation of the air on the hairs of my face. And it got so loud that I expected, as an electrical engineer, the only place I'd heard anything like it was in a laboratory, which was just before high levels of voltage discharge into a bang and you get the flash of light. And I expected something to manifest. I became afraid. I looked to see where I could run out the field, and as my disposition changed from one of tranquility and requesting to what the hell is this and I'm ready to run, right. The moment that happened, it stopped. And so I had two, it seemed to me, as I hope a rational person, I simply had something when I asked for it, and it stopped as soon as I became fearful. And I shared that information every day with people close to me. My family heard it to boredom. Every day I would say, my goodness me, that was so important. I know that that was so important. Well, that was interactive. If I take it at face value, it then showed up again a year later at Chesfoot Head. It showed up on an interview Pat and I was doing separately for BBC television and destroyed the television camera. And it was recorded again. We had the sound recorded by BBC and other people, and Paul Vigay did that too with others. And it was the same sound, 5.2 kilohertz, audible frequency, interactive, it taking effect in the environment of the crop circles because that's where we were, and interacting with us. Well, as soon as I then, in 1999, I was looking at hoaxing because it was becoming a problem that we were aware of, and Lawrence Rockefeller funded me for 2 years to look specifically at that problem. And in so doing, I began to talk with people making circles. I should have done it years before, but I'll be frank with you. The people that were making these, as far as I was concerned, were deceivers. They were deceptive. They were people that had cost everybody a lot of money and time. It was just a darn nuisance to everybody concerned. So I wasn't talking with them. But when I began to, as a result of this particular project, some of it was undercover, I began to hear from these people who I had not liked from what they were doing, mm-hmm. the same thing. It was the same stuff. And maybe I could just give you quickly one particular report. This was from a guy, Graham Pritchard, nearly left me there. Graham Pritchard was the name. He might be listening to us now. And here's a man who drew up a design, a flower of life, a quite intricate pattern. He drew this on his paper with his brother, and they planned out how they were going to make it at a place called Barbary Castle. It's quite a famous field now, Four Crop Circles. Mm-hmm. And this is now going back 3 or 4 years, and at least that, and decided that they would make this. Well, his brother became ill this particular evening, and it was not made. But in that very field, that very night, the Flower of Life design, exactly the one they planned, did form. And to this day, Graham is a person I am now in quite regular contact with. He's been very helpful, as of now other people making them, who are still a darn nuisance in many ways. But that, you know, the fact that they're giving us information which broadens the horizons here and brings this whole thing into a whole different area. You know, we are, I think, being taken down a path that demonstrates to us that we are the creators of our own universe, and that in interacting with our belief system in a faith-based manner is how we produce the world around us. It will be whatever we wish it, desire it, and action it to be. At the moment, regrettably, we're living at the end of a period of deception and lies at such a level that it's now coming back to bite our tails, and we're losing the anchorage of religion and multinational companies. We know it all. You know, we've all seen it, the economy and all the rest of it, which I don't want to particularly get political about. But we are at the back end of infrastructures which are collapsing because it's what we created. We created it by deception and lies, and here we are. And so at the end of a cycle, and hopefully the beginning of another, a new paradigm will give us a new opportunity to build again based upon a different mindset. So that's really all come out of the crop circles.
Wow.
And the UFO. And I agree with you absolutely wholeheartedly that the UFO subject and the crop circle phenomenon are very closely associated.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we're about halfway through, I think, at this point, so I'm going to turn it over to Jeremy. But I got a couple more for you that I want to hit you with after he's done. So, Jeremy, fire away there.
Sure. Hi, Jeremy.
Hello. Wow, where to begin? Well, first I want to say I had completely dismissed crop circles over the years. Of course, when I was younger, I really wanted to believe in them, and then I just thought the evidence was such that there was no evidence. And then I saw your presentation at the X conference, and that immediately made me do, yet again, a 180. And now, you know, I don't even want to say I'm a believer. I just think that what you present is so shockingly real that it is real. And so that's where I am with it now. And, you know, as you're talking about sound, it's interesting. We had a guest, Teoxin Ghost Horse, who's a Lakota gentleman, who says that corn and I assume other crops emit a sound, and that a lot of the Lakota songs and a lot of, well, Native American songs, period, are based on the tones that these crops make. Does that jive with what you're talking about, or do you think that your tone was less plant intelligence and more something robotic or something electronic?
Well, you've given me something that I was not aware of, and I have to say that's something that I will follow up. When you're saying, if I could ask you a question,
sure.
Maybe we reverse this now for a few minutes.
it's a Colin Andrews show, people.
That's right. It's the end of the Colin Andrews show. How do you mean that the sound comes from the plants? I mean, they're kind of emanating from the stem or the head, or it's a frequency we actually can't hear but can measure? And I'm not quite...
I'm not certain. He just said that if if you know how to listen, basically.
I see, yeah.
That they emit this, and that, so for, and it's different for different parts of the country, and you can extrapolate the world, so that if he were to go to Hopi land and listen to, and you know, play a song from the corn that he had heard where he's from, the corn there might not recognize it.
Wow.
Because it's a,
well, it's fascinating. I mean, it's like it's cybernetics or, I mean, see, the chest head sound is infrasound. The fact that the trees are transmitting it, that's in electrical, as electricity, effectively. It's a microphone, the probe of the microphone. In other words, you take the microphone away from the ends of two wires on your tape recorder and stick one probe into the bark of the tree, into the upright, you know, major trunk of the tree, and the other end of the wire, which in other words is the other probe, into the ground. So you've got a potential difference between the two, and across that, between the tree trunk and the ground, is this sound frequency. It's just infrasound. So it would be true to say that those trees there, and we have the record of what types of trees they are transmitting this sound, which is the same sound, by the way, that the dolphins use to communicate. And interestingly, also, is the United States submarines use this also, obviously, below the water, which is obviously why there's this big outrage going on about the interfering with the honing systems of the dolphins. But it is the same sound. And so what you're saying is very interesting and may well fall into the same category. That's certainly something that you see, this is where we probably would be now if we had started as we intended to do in July to have another look at that sound related to plants this time because of the trees that Pat Delgado had discovered the sound coming from this year.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you have a sample of that sound, I could pass it on to him and see if it's similar to what he's talking about.
Well, that's fantastic. In fact, I can tell you right now, I would happily do that. But if anybody listening, yourself and listeners and the gentleman concerned, if it just head on to colinandrews.net, go to Chesfoot Head, and the sounds are there. The sound from the trees that were recorded by Pat before he became ill, which we will be following up on, and the Chesfoot Head sound, and also the BBC sound, which destroyed their camera the day we were doing the BBC interview. So all of those are there with the analysis for you and anybody to have a look at.
Okay, great. I'll direct them to it.
Okay.
So here's my big catch-all question for you. you've been at this 30 years. Is there anything in your conclusions now and in all of the ways that you've seen this phenomenon affect people and affect you and all of that, is there anything that if you took a time machine and went back to yourself 30 years ago that you wouldn't believe back then? Is there something that took 30 years for you to be able to get, or could you have gotten it all back then?
Wow, what a great question. Well, I'm certainly a different person. I can tell you that, and my family will tell you that. A very kind of yes or no black and white engineer. You know, my job was to resolve problems, and those are found in within known parameters in physics. You know, it wasn't the mystery remaining after you look at a piece of equipment that has failed or not left with you for 30 years, wondering how in the world it all connects together. I've certainly been profoundly affected by something which I've seen evolve at a number of levels, Jeremy, not just physically the actual phenomenon itself, which has evolved in a number of ways, the complexity being one, but two, the deception, human behavior. It disappoints me greatly. I've seen, for example, we'll say a relatively new mystery enter the arena, as the UFO did in 47, so the crop circles did in late 70s, early 80s. And with that, I was privileged to be one of the first through the door. And in fact, I know I was in the first team, three or four of us, the first people on the, in the world looking at them seriously, outside of the government, which who presumably were. If they were doing their job, they would have been. And so what I witnessed was, first of all, starting the government end, was the intelligence agencies infiltrating the groups as the years passed. Some we got to know who they were, others we did not and could only guess at. That's how kind of nonsense game still goes on. So you have, you know, you have kind of government doing their job, trying to find out what you know about what they know, etc. And then you have the mystery, the funny brigade arrive on the scene, the skeptics, so I call them grade one and two. I've every all the time in the world for a skeptic. I mean, that's what it's all about, you know, is having people that will challenge you to better information. I have no problem with it. I actually enjoy speaking to skeptical people. I mean, we should all be very questioning of everything in front of us. I don't have a lot of time for what I call grade two skeptic, who are cynical about everything, have not a positive thought or contribution to society other than to down anybody and everybody that does. And so I have no time for that. I don't feel to waste my time with people who, before they've even picked the microphone up or the telephone, are determined to destroy you. And there is no mileage in that for any of us. You know, we're living in a time right now that we're in a hurry to resolve a lot of our behaviors, and that's not one I've got time for. And so as far as the phenomenon is concerned, it has tweaked me spiritually. I've been, well, obviously honored and privileged to have been involved in this at many levels. I've traveled the world many times over. I've met wonderful people. I have many contacts inside of government, you know, like Nick Pope, as you know, if you were at the X conference where Nick and I had, regrettably, to be, basically, he's sat in the audience, I'm up on the stage, and basically countering one of his official documents and his, you know, his United Kingdom official policy statements. But I like Nick. He was doing his job, and he was one of those people I was privileged to meet in his job in the Ministry of Defence. And since somewhat, I'll say somewhat outside of it, because as you know, he's sworn to the Official Secret Act, and that lasts for life. So he has some difficulties he will have to live with for the rest of his life. So it's affected me greatly. And what it has done now is that it has very much focused me upon society and human consciousness, for the reasons that, you know, Jeff raised with the UFO and the similarity with the interactive facet and the expansion of the UFO phenomena in many ways beyond whether it's a hard physical object or vehicle of some kind, as to how it could move its contours and shape and interact with the individuals by lasers and all the rest of it, if it were not exactly in some way connected with the function of the human mind. And so that's where I am now, but it's a long way from where I was as an electrical engineer and, you know, and an official in regional government back all those years ago.
And yeah, you mentioned Nick Pope, and you know, I had asked him after that in the aftermath of the roast.
Yeah. I'm sorry it was that, but
no,
I think it really was.
I mean,
yeah.
It was a necessary evil, if you want to call it that. I wouldn't even call it that, I guess. It was just necessary. But I asked him, you know, had his opinion of crop circles changed? Because I'd interviewed him before, and he had said farmers are paid to let these crop circle hoaxers in, and he's gone out with the hoaxers, and he knows that it's all hoaxes, and the farmers are in on it. It's just like a big shell con game.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and there you are, laying it out with documents and articles and all this stuff, and it didn't change his mind, or at least he said it didn't. Did you talk to him afterward, and
yes.
Had he a change of heart?
Well, it's in just one or two different areas that he has changed his ideas. It's not changed his ideas at all about the complexity of the complex crop circles. He feels that they are probably all man-made. I think that is where he comes from. What has changed his mind, and I've had several discussions with him since Washington. We did a BBC interview about a radio interview 2 weeks after that conference, where he acknowledged on BBC on the air live that the case that I had made with regard to the involvement of the British government, the Ministry of Defence, and the involvement and interest of the Queen, which had been questioned by him severely in the official document, that is the official government's position, was the Queen had no interest, the Prime Minister had no interest, there were no high-level meetings about crop circles, the police in central southern England were not involved at all in surveillance operations of any kind, with civilians or not, and the answer to every single one of those points, and some I've missed, like the D notice, you know, the position that the government can take to stop censor media at the throwing of a switch in Great Britain, and similar provisions exist here too. And he said that in his official documentation, the official policy statement, that they had, that is the British government, had never attempted to censor any media with regard to any event related to the crop circles or UFO. And I knew it to be wrong because I was involved in one. And so, as you saw, and your listeners may not know, is that during Operation Blackbird, a surveillance operation back in 1990, a number of strange things happened, which we probably don't have time to go into because it's kind of a whole program of its own. But a D notice was issued to take off air immediately a particular event that occurred there. And I have, as I showed it in Washington, D.C., the documentation and the evidence from the well-known television and radio journalist in Great Britain who was on the air at the time and when they shut the station down with a D notice. So Nick has had to say all, I mean, I have personal letters from the Queen, from the Deputy Prime Minister, from the Chief, personal letters from the Chief Scientific Advisor. I was in the top secret air establishment at Boscombe Down. I have their photographs. I have the police photographs. And nobody could say that I don't and that they don't exist. So, unfortunately, humble pie is all Nick had to do. So, I'm sorry, and I think, you know, I think the great thing about it is he was humble and honest enough to say, well, I had a job to do. It was our position to play down the UFO and the crop circle phenomenon, and that's what I did. But the Colin Andrews documentation proves there was a greater interest than I was aware of. And so that's it. We're all okay. But the very point, which is worth making on air again now, is that when any government, the British government, the American government, or any other, like the Brazilians are currently doing now, when they come forward and tell us, the public, that they are now releasing hitherto secret documents related to the UFO, they better be doing so. And it better be just exactly that. That these are the documents. We do not have time left on this planet for any more of this nonsense. You know, if you're going to come clean with the information, which the UK did not do necessarily on phase one, they're adjusting on phase two. And I think that by the time they get to see, the public really are ready for this, and we do want the truth, the whole darn lot of it, then perhaps then the US will come forward and give us the bottom line, which I think most people involved in this research, like yourselves, know that the US are holding some major, major cards here. And I think we're ready for it because we need it. We need consciousness to take us to a new place, and that will come with the truth.
Well, when you say that was Nick Pope's job was to downplay this stuff, what's his job now?
Well, that's a great question. I can't answer that, of course. Nick will be the guy to answer it. It's a great question, and I guess I really just have to say that we've been given one example of not having the truth under the direct management of his bosses at the Ministry of Defence, and he now is officially released from his position, but still sworn to the Official Secrets Act. I think the answer has got to be, and I will eat humble pie if it comes to this, that he is still sworn to the policy of the British Ministry of Defence, and if they are downplaying certain things that have already happened, things that will happen in the coming years, and he's told to play it one way, he will play it one way, and that's the name of the game there. I like Nick a lot, and in fact, my wife is not too many feet away from me as I speak to you. She knows that when I return from meetings in London with Nick, and this is years ago, I not only liked Nick Pope, I thought he was a new generation that were going to be doing some things. I felt in him that he may have himself had some experiences, and we will wait to see. But he has proven to be that he is the bridge. I mean, he is the communicator of from the civilian position of the Ministry of Defence. He's the guy that's been in those vaults and was head of the UFO project for the British government. So we'll wait and see, but it's a great question. The answer will be whatever lies ahead, and I hope it is the truth.
It's interesting you brought up Project Blackbird. I was in high school when Unsolved Mysteries did
their
thing on the crop circles, and they had mentioned Project Blackbird and that you guys had gotten video of something creating these crop circles. And then they said they were going to follow up on it, and they never did. And I remember I was doing a paper in high school, a science paper on crop circles. And so I called. The only person I knew of was Ray Fowler, because I'm from Massachusetts.
Yes.
His son was in the phone book. So his son actually gave me his phone number, and he had just stepped off a plane. He was in England and said that the Project Blackbird video footage was confiscated by the military. And that's why there was no follow-up on it. Am I remembering that correctly? Is that what happened?
Well, you're remembering it almost correctly, certainly. I can tell you what actually happened. Your version is very close to it. The only difference is that what I've always called the yellow tape, just to set this up, we had a bank of image intensifier cameras, low-light cameras, image intensifiers, infrared, and each camera was looking at a different area of the landscape below this escarpment, which was owned by the Ministry of Defence. And this was also in Nick Pope's reign, by the way. And so we had these cameras filming day and night for 10 days. And within the first 48 hours, something happened early hours in the morning. I was at that time at home asleep. I coordinated the operation with the British military, with the BBC and Nippon Television Japan. And the one camera picked up in the yellow, VCR, which was recorded, an event. Well, I reacted to this. It was part of a protocol that we had a film crew came out that were staying locally for Nippon Television in Japan, who 90% funded the whole operation. So they were going to transmit this to the world if something had happened ahead of the BBC by a matter of hours, was part of the deal. And they were mobilized. I was mobilized. I went off over there in my vehicle and Pat and so on. And when we got there, it was kind of all hell let loose. There were media coming in from London. There were satellite dishes being put up, and it was an absolute circus going on there. But what happened was that I was told verbally that a triangular-shaped object had been seen above the field that night, and that it had been recorded. And obviously, before I was asked to do the first television news item from the site at first light, which went out on BBC Breakfast Time television, came into Good Morning America here, I think, a little bit afterwards. And by the time the dust had settled and that I'd seen for myself what had happened, was directly in front of the the operation, a hoax had been perpetrated. That's, again, a whole other program. We could talk about it because there's too much involved in how it arrived there, etc. But in a field to the left, something else happened, which was on a VCR tape, which was removed from the site without me seeing it and or anybody else seeing what it had actually recorded. That was removed, and as far as I know, to this day, as far as I know, what I'm told is that it was sent to Nihon University in Japan for analysis. That's the short version. There's too many other laterals to that that I don't think be prepared to say on air, because there's so much that we don't know. But I've never been told, and there have not been any real indications, because I would say that if the military had taken that themselves and military were on the side, I would tell you so, because you've given me a straight question and I will give you a straight answer. But it became very deliberately confusing for me to be able to trace precisely the steps that were taken and to precisely who managed the removal of that tape. But so mystery still remains about what happened on Blackbird. But and yet we now know that a secret site, which I was aware of a secret site at Silbury Hill, but what I was not aware of at the time was that the military had filmed there for themselves. A bright white light over a field where circles were discovered at first light. So a whole, maybe there's another program there, but a lot of stuff was going on around Blackbird.
Let me ask you this, and then I'll turn it back over to Jeff, or else I'll end up stealing what I know are his questions.
Okay.
Don't do it.
Yeah. Now, you want disclosure. You said that the U.S. government needs to disclose. Well, if we're going to say that this is about consciousness and not about nuts and bolts aliens that, well, I guess as the disclosure movement has it, you know, it's sort of they're just like us, you know, just waiting for us to join the Galactic Federation. If it's not about all of that, if it is indeed more alien than that, or even more transcendentally human than that, What would disclosure actually do? Why is that so important?
Well, I think it's important because whatever it is, let's just have it for what it is. If there's nuts and bolts evidence from Roswell or anywhere else, and many people, from the Jesse Marcells to the rest of the well-known individuals that have come forward with evidence surrounding the Roswell event itself. Many would say that there absolutely was nuts and bolts evidence that the U.S. have and know it and have lied about it ever since, including, you know, lying to his own father. And so if they do have this, and that is so, let's have it. Let's have what happened on the East Coast there at Bentwaters. There's many, many witnesses. I've spoken to many myself. You know, in fact, I was with some of them just a few weeks ago. And, you know, again, if they know it, and there's every indication they do, that they're just denying the public access to important information of the nuts and bolts kind, let's have it. And I agree with you, that if we're looking at the evolution of consciousness and other parameters that we've just not adequately studied, then let's have that too. So, the whole thing shrouded in secrecy is not the way we're going to move into the new paradigm. And I do think we are indeed moving into a new paradigm. There's too much happening around us right now, multi-layered, that really, really cries out for the very latest science, the very, very top line knowledge on all of these parameters, of which the UFO offers one part of that equation. And so that's what I would expect release to be. I would expect a very highly intelligent conversation. Who knows what happened at the Vatican last week, or was it the week before? But they, as you know, had their study, a whole week of discussion on this. And let's have our discussion with the people we voted into position. I'm sure, actually, it won't come from the people we voted in position, but the civil servants, the guys that run the show, do know. I mean, you know, I know John Alexander and these other individuals. These guys have access to information that you and I don't. It's wrong. I think it's simply wrong that we're growing into a new period, or we're going to fall short here and lose it. That's where I fall, and so that would be my answer, Jeremy. That whatever they know, let's have it. And if they truly do not have it, then let's have them look us right in the eyes and tell us that. I don't believe it for a moment. Not for a moment. Is there nothing to tell us? This is what we've spent our couple of hours on now, and there's a lot more. And there's a lot more that's going to open our eyes, I'm sure, if they give it to us.
Well, would you believe them if they've been lying to us all these years? Would you believe whatever comes out of their mouth?
No, I mean, at the moment, I believe very little that comes out of their mouth. But I'm hopeful, as I think we have to be, for our children and for our future, that we are at some point on this planet going to be talking face-to-face with humanity who respects one another, that knows what the value of truth, which leads to a contentment, which is love. I mean, this coming from a guy, I used to be a boxer and a fireman and a sportsman, and as kind of rough and tumble as anybody. But, you know, the bottom line, that that glues us together, is love. And I don't hear or see enough of it. And it's all, I know it's kind of, we got there sort of kind of out of nowhere. Suddenly we're talking about, or I am talking about the word love, but it's in the center of it all. And, you know, we're not going to get anywhere near that as a nation or as an international community unless it comes to the center of our discussion. You know, there are too many sides, there's too much conflict, there's too many personalities and egos. We've got to cut through it. Time is running out, and this is the time for the UFO subject to be concluded as best it can, even if it leaves many questions, which I'm sure it will do, but we're ready for it now because we're coming apart here, and this is the time.
Colin, one of the things that, and I guess I should kind of preface this by telling you, since you probably haven't heard our show before.
I have,
Oh, have you? Okay, great. Jeremy and I both have had close relation with the UFO subject, me since I was 5 years old. That frankly, over the course of most of my life, has scared the hell out of me in plain out words. And one of the things that I found especially weird in reading on your website was this whole case that I think you were involved in about the time that I first contacted you about the interview, which was this Tall Whites case reported by the police officer near Formation. And the reason I say that is because this policeman has now, if I'm reading right, has gone on to report something that I've talked about as well, which is a kind of ghost and or slash poltergeist type activity around him since this has happened. Can you speak a little bit about that case and where it stands right now?
Yes, certainly. And I think just to add this, as it just happened live, I don't know whether you heard in the background as you were talking to me about this particular point, the Microsoft sound come over the speakers here. Yeah. But I'm sat in a bank of computers at my home in Connecticut. And each of these computers, there are three here that have just closed down one after the other without me touching a single button.
Well, you're welcome.
That just happened right there. Right there. Each one, it's the first time that has ever happened, I can tell you, and each one has just fallen straight out without any power cuts. Anyway, there you go. That happened live.
Well, here's something else, and I'll bring this up right now because Jeremy and I have talked about this a lot. Right now, during this conversation, does anybody else besides me feel the air right now? I mean, I'm not kidding. When you get this deep into this subject, as we're getting right now, the air seems to change.
Yeah.
I mean, there is a definitive feeling in this room I'm in right now.
I felt like crying for about the past hour, and I have no idea why. No, seriously.
No, I mean...
It's weird. Well, several times, more about 20 minutes ago, I think, the mute went extremely quiet on my phone. I actually thought that the program had been disconnected from me, because I was about to say, but I didn't feel to do so because we were on air, are you still there? Because the mute dropped you, both of you, out to such a degree I thought I was talking to myself. So the air certainly is a little electric, shall we say.
It is a little weird, yeah.
Well, certainly, just to answer your point, Jeff, yes, the police officer, he's a police sergeant in Wiltshire Police, 6th of July this year. This is the case you're referring to, isn't it?
Yes, sir.
That was driving from Devizes, where he had been on duty, to his home in Marlborough, coming up to Silbury Hill, the tallest man-made mound in Europe. On his left-hand side, he was driving the A4 highway, and to the right-hand side, just as he's approaching the hill, on his right, he was aware as a police officer that there was a crop design in the field. You couldn't see it from the road. It was on a higher ground there. But he was aware it was there because Wiltshire Police are getting calls all the time about, you know, from farmers and nuisance parking, etc., surrounding the crop circles in that area. So he was aware of it being there. It was actually a Mayan headdress kind of pattern, crop circle in that field. And so he's approaching there, and he saw three humans. They were all each rather tall, and he saw them there as he's just doing his policeman's job. He's looking at them. This is early hours in the morning, just after 5 o'clock. And as he got closer, he noticed that they were all identically dressed in white suits, white kind of like work suits, tight-fitting with their hoods dropped down to the back of their necks. Each had blonde hair, and the more it kind of came home as to why they looked odd to him, the more he became alarmed that these were each in excess of 6 feet, fairly well in excess of 6 feet. They were identically dressed, and when he saw their faces, they looked the same. Long blonde hair, their cheekbones were high cheekbone, their eyes were slightly larger than ours. I've kind of somewhat jumped here, because by this time, by looking at his features and knowing what he was really looking at, he had stopped his vehicle, he had parked up, he had shouted to them from the side of the highway, and it was as if they were completely oblivious to the fact he was there. They took no notice. They carried on, he said, looking as if they were looking at or testing the plants. He thought that perhaps initially that they were forensic from the police themselves or from some plant group of some sort, organization. But clearly, by looking at them, these were strange beings. And he climbed through the barbed wire fence, where I later flew over to England and went and took the same route, through this wired fence into the field, and again he called out to them, and they then did respond. He said that this is all happening within seconds. He said that the plants were moving as if the wind was blowing the heads of the plant, but there were plants, but there was no wind. There was no air movement, but that he heard this crackling sound, which seemed to be the sound waving seemed to connect with the movement of the plants. When the plants would move, the crackling sound would take place, and so it sounded as if to him like there was some kind of electrical energy field around these people or these beings. And so he called out again the second time. They did react, and when they reacted, the movement of the plants waved down towards him, and as the energy field, which I will call it, it's not what he said, I'm just in relating it to you to communicate it, as that those plants and that energy field reached him, he immediately suffered a very severe headache, which he had for the rest of the day. He looked back at his car to see where he could get out of the barbed wire fence quickly, because it, as you know, it's a rather kind of difficult thing to do. Barbed wire is a nasty kind of material. And as soon as he looked back, these beings were, he said, running faster than any person he has ever seen. And they then simply just disappeared. It was, people have asked, as we have asked, Andy Russell is the frontline researcher that has actually got the contact with this police officer. He's probably very wisely curtailing his own involvement with other researchers or the media. He's refused media interviews. The police have somewhat shielded him by saying that what's happening to him as a police officer is a private deal, that they, the police force, are not involved, which I think is probably kind of a wise thing to do. But these beings were running away, moving away at speed, but then simply disappeared. When we arrived there, I went there, Busty Taylor, my wife, and a couple of others, retraced the steps as plotted in the field by the police officer, and discovered that there were tracks there that indeed moved only in one direction into the standing crop and simply terminated, as if they disappeared, which is what he said they did do, disappeared. Well, when he went home, he got in his vehicle, basically a changed man. His reality changed there on the spot. He's suffering greatly by what has happened to him, and then things very weird began to happen at his home. He had people, well, I'm saying people, of course, he had tappings at the door, his front door, to open the door to find nobody was there. He had electrical lights coming on and off, just like my computer just did, without him touching anything. He's had two very powerful UFO experiences outside of his home. He'd had none of this before. He said to people that I'm working with that he's sorry that any part of this ever happened, because his life is upside down. It's like something went home with him. It's a very strange situation. He has described to the police artistry division, these people that, you know, draw from eyewitnesses, bank robbers and so on, I mean, just facial features to help bring forward witnesses to these individuals. They have sketched these tall beings, and I am told, this is the latest, that Nippon Television have shown an interest in putting together a very carefully documented television program, which he has agreed to appear on in silhouette. He doesn't want to be seen, his features to be seen, but he's prepared to go on television and to make a one-off statement with the police's own artist's impression of what he saw. So wow. That's the kind of long description, the very latest, and as much as I can certainly say about that experience.
I know we're winding down here. I did want to ask you one thing, and again, it's a selfish question because it's related to something that I've noticed in the way of, and I feel like somehow this applies to you with the whole crop circle thing and all the years that you've spent in this and all that you've lost and given up for this. I've noticed over the years that part of my thinking has leaned towards that this phenomena, whatever it is, I'll just call it the anomaly, which encompasses everything, seems to do what I put akin to fishing terms of trolling, that it trolls essentially to get the attention of someone or a group of people of some sort. And I know that in my own experiences with this is that these beings that I have seen, and they have changed not too awfully long ago, but they seem to have a real hell-bent desire to be acknowledged as real, in that they want me to touch them. They want me to look at them. They want me to interact more. They want me to talk about them more. And all of this seems to facilitate their ability to manifest in this reality that we're in. Do you think it's possible that, and I know this would only be probably a guess on your part, do you think it's possible that this police officer, yourself, Jeremy, me, all of us who have seen this stuff, the numbers of which seem to be growing by the amount of interest here lately in the paranormal, do you think it's a possibility that this actively put out a hook and you bit it and the officer bit it and therefore we're all having these experiences by virtue of our focus upon it?
Yeah, I mean, the straight answer is absolutely yes. And I don't know how you feel about this, but that from my own personal experience, and there's nothing stronger, is there? I was good to hear you speaking there about personal experiences, because those are the ones that you're not looking for anybody to convince you about. You know what you've seen. You know what has happened to you. And I only know that in the half a dozen or so experiences that I've personally had, that I've found in many hours of analyzing each of them in to myself, you know, not trying to satisfy anybody else's criteria, just my own, the only common denominator I have been able to find, and I would hold on to it until I'm kind of prove it not to to be so, is that in each case I have myself been involved in a mind process, but more than that, that I've come from a position of absolute deep sincerity, and I hold with this until other experiences show it not to be, you know, to be crucial, as it were. But those things that have happened to me have come from a position of me sincerely, I mean very sincerely, trying to establish new information, and it's like the front of my conscious, since being sincere with my subconscious, as it were, you know, that this discussion's going on in two parts of my brain, which appear then to connect with a bigger life force, that from a higher place. And, you know, that's, of course, where ultimately we finish up, maybe not you and I disagreeing, but with religion, disagreeing with other forms of religion, that we're looking to answer, where is that coming from? You know, is it a God, Allah, or what is that higher being? But I'm totally convinced it exists, but is it something ahead of us in time? Is it something from the past? Is it the Akashic field, the Akashic record, that all that has been and the all that will ever be, and that we experience it in our reality only if we connect or attempt, as you're saying, make a deliberate attempt to connect with it, that it's out there kind of dangling a carrot and just waiting to see if somebody will bite. But when you bite, and you bite sincerely, and you're after interaction because you want to know more, then you become part of it. And I agree with the tenure, the direction that you've taken, you know, that as a suggestion. I certainly believe that. That's where I think it all is right now.
Jeremy, do you have anything else?
I think that's a perfect place to leave this.
I do too.
But I think that you have to come back on the show.
Yes. Will you please come back on?
Well, absolutely. Absolutely. And thank you both for being so well researched and very enjoyable to talk with.
Well, I did want to say, I heard I just watched your X Conference DVD again last night for about the 15th millionth time. and I heard you mention in there that you had lost so much to this over the years, your country, on and on that it went. And I think I can speak for Jeremy and all of our listeners in saying that you didn't lose anything in vain, because we really appreciate everything that you've done over the whole course of what you've done. And this has been a real pleasure to have you on the show. And like I say, I hope we'll get you back really soon.
Well, thank you, Jeff, and thank you very much, Jeremy. I've enjoyed it. Very much appreciate that.
It's been an honor, sir.
Hi, this is Richard Dolan. You're listening to Paratopia. Wait, Paratopia Radio?
No, Paratopia is fine.
That was good.
Thank you.
Get that last part, too, where I say, wait, Paratopia Radio?
Wow, Jeff.
Is everybody's jaws up off the floor at this point? Because mine's not.
That was something.
Jesus. There's the guy. There's the guy for me. I mean, that's it. That's it. What do you say after a show like that? I mean,
yeah, there are so many things that, like, you know, I would love to have him back on now, right now.
I know. We had a nice after chat too, which was great. I mean,
yeah, a lot of great stuff came up in that we need to flesh out on the air, you know.
And you know what? And here's the thing, and I'll say this unequivocally to everybody: there's a guy who has spent a lot of his life and has lost an immeasurable amount of his life to this, and is still one of the kindest, most generous guys that you've ever met in this field. And I frankly can't wait to have him back on. I mean, we've got so much that we didn't get to ask him because we didn't want to suck up all of his evening. But
I don't know if it's him or his delivery. I don't know what it is, but I got that same feeling that I got when I heard Make the X conference, where I just want to cry. It's something that just grows in my chest, and suddenly I'm in a state of wanting to tear up and cry. And I don't know what is that.
Because he is he's an open book. I mean, if he can tell you, he'll tell you everything that he's analytically looked at, everything that he's researched, and then everything that he thinks about it, down to the core of what he thinks. And that's a rarity in this. I mean, he is, you know, a rarity that you won't get many researchers to tell you, this is what I think. I mean, that just doesn't happen. You get the facts and only the facts, or you get only what they think. With him, you get both. How it's affected his life. Yeah, God damn it, that was good. I mean, that was like the best show ever to me, ever. I mean, really.
Let's take a moment and breathe. Now, all right, let's try to get into some semblance of detail here. Now, when he talked about seeing a UFO in one field and it was faked in another field that same night, did I hear that correctly?
I think so.
Now, does that sound suspiciously like the Phoenix Lights, where you've got one thing that happens that's completely, you know, real or unidentified, and then the big faked spectacular event that everybody videotapes?
The camouflaging of the actual event, you know. I don't know, because, I mean, look at it this way. The way, and I hope that this came across right for our audience, that essentially he expounds on it a lot more in the X conference lecture, where he speaks of, let's just take advantage of the popularity of Doug and Dave. Doug and Dave were the two old guys who came out way back when and said, yeah, we've been hoaxing these circles for years, and you know, we go out to the pub, we get half tanked up on some stout, and we go out and make some circles. But what even they said was that after a while, they said, why are we still doing these? And it was because they felt compelled to do them. The people who are actively making circles now or formations now, they call themselves, you know, crop artists or sewer artists or whatever, are saying that they're witnessing balls of light above them as they're making these symbols in the fields. They're having other phenomena that happens to them. Now, it's very easy to say on the outside of things that, well, these guys are hoaxers. So, of course, they're going to lie and say that they're seeing these things as well. The problem is Colin Andrews has seen these things as well. So he knows what to listen for. He knows what earmarks are out there that can negate or, you know, substantiate a certain claim by any of these people. They feel compelled to do these. The instance he gave was of the man planning one out with a relative. The relative gets sick. They don't do it. It still shows up. You know, that, again, so when you're talking about, here's a faked one over here, and here's the legitimate phenomena above another field, did one cause the other? You know? Let's go back to George Hansen. You know, does the marginality effect apply there? Hell yeah, it applies. You know, it's marginalized. It's casting doubt upon itself. Back to McKenna again. The phenomena is doing that. I mean, to me, that seems right. If I understood that story right, I think that's what was going on.
Mm-hmm. Sorry.
No, what?
I'm just still in shock. I don't know. There was something about that that was just, I don't know, the whole thing. And then with the computers going off and the high strangeness and the whatever all came at the same time.
You didn't feel that? I mean,
I felt it.
I'm not kidding you. Yes. Yes. I mean, everything was, it just feels like the air changes. And I knew, you know, about halfway through that we were into it. I mean, that we were in the freaking groove with Colin Andrews. And here we are, and we're talking about this, and it's listening. I had that proximity type of feeling. The air just feels different. I hope to God that transfers onto the podcast.
I want to, the next time we have him on, part of what we talked about privately had to do with symbols and had to do with triangles. And I think if we have him back on, we should have him on with Teokas and Ghost Horse to talk about some of these things. I just think he'd have a lot to offer, you know? I think they would have a lot to offer each other, you know?
Yeah. I mean,
that might be a show for the ages. If Teokas would do it, I don't know that he would, but.
Yeah. I mean, it's amazing. I mean, you know, you think about where this guy is. He's run the whole gambit of this subject that he's studied for all these years, and he's saying, you know, the conclusion right now for this point in time is this. And I mean, for me, it just coincides so completely with the way I feel about the whole thing.
It's so interesting that you know, you hear this stuff and you hear about, I lost my country, this and that fell apart, you know,
right.
My partner dies, my other partner dies.
Yeah.
All of this loss and all of these strange things being pulled into this circle and who knows what's going to happen. All of these scary, fearful things. And yet the outcome is that this is all about love. And, you know, once I wish we'd fleshed that out more, because I feel like there's something in that. There's something about all of this stuff that you know, that you and I, we talk about and people on our message boards or just in general don't necessarily embrace, which is, for instance, the hero's journey, which ultimately ends up in the hero being a hero and being an enlightened whatever at the end of it, is you got to go through hell. You got to burn. You got to get there to get that.
Well, it's being broken down, isn't it?
I mean, that's what it is. But there's also, and then there's also something about this use of language that there's this, whatever this thing is, it's holistic in that, in ways that we aren't able to conceive of yet. And I think, again, this is where Teokas and Ghost Horse comes in handy, because I think the Lakota can conceive of it in some ways because they do listen to nature. They do read signs in things. They do work with intuition as fluently as we work with logic, and probably as fluently as they work with logic. I mean, it's all of a movement, and I think that if any psychologist is going to tell you that the thing that we think is most real about ourselves is this shallow conscious self that we present to the world, and that the real thing that's us is all the stuff underneath that surface. And if you have some sort of intelligence that speaks with all of that at the same time, that movement, that communication is going to break down accordingly through the receiver, through us. And so it's going to look scary. It's going to look evil. It's going to look angelic. It's going to look deep and dark and all of that stuff. And you got to sort of push through it to get to the very simple thing of it's all about love. Now, and I think we got to flesh that out. and figure out what love means at that point, because it certainly doesn't mean a coddling God who sits in a heaven and answers your wishes. And it certainly isn't necessarily the same as like a mother loves her child love. It's not in love, like romantic love. So what is this thing we're talking about when we say love?
And you'll have to, you know, either edit this out or just remind me that I did. Did I ever talk about the bliss experience going down 95 on the show? Have I talked about that yet?
I don't think so.
I'll make this extraordinarily brief. When I was buying my house, I think anybody who on the message board or a listenership that has bought a house knows how incredibly stressful that is. And it was extraordinarily stressful for me, even though our purchase of a home went through so smoothly that the bank and our real estate agent said he'd never seen anything so smooth. But be that as it may, I was a nervous wreck. I had taken to driving to work and I guess meditating on things going smoothly, things being right, and feeling all of those feelings of what it would be like when I walk through the door into my new house, how happy I would be. I felt all of that. I didn't think about bad things happening. I didn't think about the bank not giving us the money or not being able to afford it or any of it. I just thought, none of that. I'm just going to focus on all that good stuff. And at the end of that, I would just get into this perpetual, which felt completely natural to me. And I know most people are going to start rolling their eyes at this one, especially coming from me. I'm not the, I'm not the meditative guy. That's you. But I just
sick,
got,
Jeff.
I got into this, this staunch researcher. Now I got into this, this perpetual feeling of just gratitude. And I didn't even know what I was throwing this gratitude out to. In other words, I was saying just thank you for everything going smoothly. Thank you for my house. Thank you for the health that I have. And thank you for the calm and the peace that it's going to be and all that. And I would just get into this perpetual thank you, thank you, thank you. And I did this every day for weeks and weeks. And I remember one day I got into just a real groove with it. I had some good music on the radio and I'm going down 95. And just before my exit, and I have no other way to explain this. So if it sounds like an airy-fairy thing to say, so be it. This is how it felt. It felt like there was something radiating from everywhere, namely from a spot up and to my right in the air that felt like, if you can possibly put it into words, you called it bliss when I explained it to you. It lasted about 30 seconds at the most. And it just felt what you would imagine in a cinematic kind of way is like God is up wherever he is and he's taking care of everybody's requests and seeing through life and death and making things happen. And for one 30-second period, he does nothing but look at you and smile. He doesn't say anything, but you have his absolutely undivided 100% attention for that short seconds of time. He's looking right at you. Now I'm not saying I saw a giant eyeball in the sky or anything like that. What I'm saying is that the totality of what's holding this reality together smiled at me. Me, nobody me. Me, just another guy me. And it was at the same time that it felt like you just wanted to melt into the seat. It also had this feeling of just hugeness beyond hugeness. And the love, and that's the only way you can describe it, and love is a trite word for what this felt like. It was just, I love you, kiddo. Except that's coming from the awe, you know? And I have no words to describe that. And then it started to, as I approached my exit, it started to ebb away. And I found myself, number one, crying for no apparent reason other than I want that again, you know, and don't leave me, you know, don't leave me because I want that to stay like just like that for the rest of my life. I don't want to be any other way. And you realize it's ebbing away because it's going back into its notion of churning out the universe or whatever the hell it's doing. I don't know. But that to me is you can feel love from mom and dad. You can feel love for your children, your dog, your wife, your family, your brother and sister. There is nothing that will compare to that. And if that's what we feel and what people say that they feel when they have near-death experiences or whatever, if that's what it is, no one should be afraid to leave this place because it is the most unbelievable feeling that I've ever had in my life. I think that's what you're talking about when you say it's all about love, you know?
Well, and I think that that's what I'm talking about when I'm pushing for this oneness I am state that I experienced that I keep saying this is what I need to be getting back to, because I think that what you're describing is, you know, unfortunately, because we're not that love, we have to experience it as a receiver. We have to experience ourselves in relationship to this thing. But in fact, we can be that thing. We can be the thing radiating, generating that love. But to listen to somebody say that, I mean, just harkens back to all the crap.
Rage crap, yeah, yeah. Exactly.
But
I mean, let me ask you something before you go on.
Yeah.
Why? Because you've had experience with this sort of thing before. Why do you think that it would radiate from like what seemed like a fixed point in the sky? What do you think? What does that harken to? Does that mean anything to you? Does that ring a bell of any sort? Have you ever felt a feeling radiate from a certain point in the sky like that?
No, I don't know. Well, I'll tell you this, and this isn't that, but it's
okay.
Similarly odd. And this is something I haven't told you, and I haven't shared with anybody actually.
It's a first.
It's a first, because what do you do with this? After we did the Harvard meeting, when I went back home, as I was just lying in bed, it wasn't like nighttime. I wasn't asleep or anything. I was just lying down on the bed resting or whatever. I mean, the room was full of this energy. You know, I could see what I normally see, which are, you know, like little beads of light buzzing around and zipping around and all this sort of staticky stuff. And what looked like two of these things sort of came in and went into my chest. And I felt like blissful, I guess. I mean, not to the extent that you're talking about, but to the extent that I then wanted to call up random people and tell them that I was in love with them.
Yes.
And just tell them I love them and tell, you know, all of this stuff. And I realized, you know, if I do this, then the next day when this effect is worn off, I'm going to be screwed, you know. It's like, it was like the drunk, you know, going, sorry.
He's a nut. Yeah. He must have been drinking something.
I didn't mean that I'm in love with you. It was just these energies that came into me. And that's what I thought of when he said, when he was talking about, I think it was it Pat, who was doing something?
Yes. Did you catch that?
Yeah. Yes. Doing something to his, what was it, solar plexus?
Yes. Yes.
I mean, what? is that not what I do?
I'm pretty sure.
Is, you know,
we got Graham. We got Graham Hancock's. Yes, we got Graham Hancock's magicians, and we have this there. I mean, this stuff keeps popping up.
It's like, you know, I almost want to say to him, "Geez, you should do ayahuasca with Graham Hancock because he's got some nature spirits that want to clean out your psychology and talk about love too."
Right. Yeah.
I mean, all of this stuff is just pushing at you from different angles. Now, as far as, you know, why would something be in a specific point in the sky? I don't know, except that I guess. Here's a question. If you don't have anything to associate this love with, like if you're not a Christian or a Buddhist or a Muslim or whatever, if you don't have that image, then where is it coming from when it does come?
Right.
Maybe it comes from a point in the sky because the closest thing you have a representative for is this quote-unquote alien business.
I don't know if it's that or whether, you know, the sky is just the prettiest part of the picture you're looking at as you're driving down the road. I mean, is that, you know, you know, I've been listening to Terrence again talk about, you know, what is truth, what is love, and then what is beauty. And he says, you know, what is truth? Tricky. What is love? Trickier. What is beauty? Everybody knows what beauty is. But then he puts the little caveat in there that says, but then again, if you know what beauty is, you're doomed to live out for the rest of your life to your own taste. So, you know, I guess the most beautiful part of that particular scenery I was looking at was the sky, but that's just what it felt like. And I remember exactly like you're saying, it's just like, it was, you know, you just kept saying, I mean, my mouth was just in this perpetual state of, I love you. I love you. I love you. I love you. I couldn't make it stop. I mean, it was just completely consuming me. And I'm driving a moving vehicle while this was going on, you know, that was a little unsettling after I thought about it, but I mean, it completely made you want to melt. It was unlike anything I've ever felt in my life. Now, I guess a psychologist or the science would say extreme stress, release of endorphins, blah, blah, blah.
No, that ain't it. It's the same
that
thing.
That ain't it.
It's the same thing as for me listening to Colin Andrews speak so passionately about this stuff, which is it's the sweet release of freedom from the clenchedness of yourself that you walk around pretending that you are. It's suddenly wiped away, you know, and even in listening to Colin Andrews speak, it's like all of the, my own pretentious stuff of like, You know, I want to ask him about all of that right. I want stuff because I'm not actually listening to listen. I'm listening to self-fortify and to pick and choose right. what I want so that I remain as I am. I mean, I'm as guilty of this as anybody else.
Sure.
I think that just goes right out the window. You're immediately confronted with the honesty of the situation of like,
yes.
and then it becomes the longing because as soon as that goes away, of course you want to recreate that. You're like, why isn't yeah. that? Oh, I get it. I can't have that because I'm me. So me has to go away for that to exist. You know mm-hmm. what I mean? I think that's what
that and there it is again.
It shines through mm-hmm. you. It dissolves you and you are that bliss state. You are that. Mm-hmm. And so once again, to get back to my own shtick, I feel like because we can do that, we must do that. I mean, why are we doing this? What are we toiling around as these little shallow end of the pool selves when there's all of this? You know, why are we sitting here and, you know, we got to debate it. If it doesn't make right. perfect logical sense, then it's out. We have to prove it to each other. What are we proving? So that we can draw right. it into this world and make it something etched in stone that's as completely crappy and shallow as we are?
Yeah, so we can label it, yeah. yeah.
And then remain and isn't that what, and then be miserable. I mean, why are we doing this?
Exactly. Well, and here's the thing. At some point, we've got to make up some kind of fake Terrence McKenna interview because I think we've got enough bits that we could ask questions.
We can do that. I mean, we can get permission.
And then we could like take and insert what he would say to these answers. Because I mean, there's another thing that he's talked about at length in a whole weekend of interview. I think this was a 5-part thing on the Psychedelic Salon. And again, if you haven't checked out the Psychedelic Salon, do yourself a favor. Lorenzo's got fantastic speakers every week. Go check out that podcast. But McKenna made a point of saying that there was all of this out there that he had tapped into the very thing that you talk about, this state, this place, and this potential to transform into something else. And he said, so I was giving this lecture, and I said this in my lecture, and somebody in the audience stood up and says, well, then why don't you just take more and do it? And he said, that's a really great question. And he says, here's my answer. Because and essentially his answer was, because I'm very comfortable where I am. Because this is what I know. And I don't know that. I think it's what I took away from it was he was saying, you know, I am in this and I have to enact myself in this. Otherwise, why am I going to do this and become this thing that I wouldn't be able to relate to 99.9% of the rest of the people? Well, that was kind of his thing.
Here's the other answer to that. You can't get there through psychedelics permanently
right.
any more than you can get there permanently through this second person relationship of a thing, a god, or whatever, smiling
right.
upon you.
Right.
That ain't going right. to cut it. You have to change from within. Psychedelics are a nice shortcut to these other realms, these other frequencies, and these other feelings, but you know, it's essentially the thing that has to change within you, and
right.
you're going to get there through artificial means.
Right. Well, I think his point was to be shown the door.
Right.
You know, he always talks about you want to be the one to be shown the purple door and walk through it and never be seen again. You don't want that to be Whitley Strieber or Jacques Vallée or any. You want to be the one to do that. And again, you talk about we want to stick a label on it. We want to label it so we can forget it and we can move on to something else and still be that same person. He spoke extensively about that, about how in his lecture on UFOs, that this is not about your entertainment. This is not for your amusement. This is for your transformation. That's what this is about. And there's a guy talking about it before anybody was talking about this kind of stuff. He got it. He explored all the edges of this kind of stuff. And, you know, so to hear somebody like Colin Andrews talk, though, is just so brutally honest, so open book. And what's really neat about it is that he does give you you go to his website, these noises, they were recorded. They're there. You can hear these yourself. You can look at the data. You can, I mean, and you get his personal experiences as well. I mean, again, that's a rare bird in all this. So, I mean, again, I can't thank him enough for coming on the show. And that was completely worth
doing,
you know,
this show.
The wait. Yeah, doing this show. Yeah, well, we had to wait. His schedule is really hectic, and we had to wait a pretty good time to get him on. And I'll tell you what, worth it more, it could not have been.
More could not have been.
That's right. There's my Yodaism for the night. That was so worth it. I can't begin to put it into words. I mean, I can't thank him enough for doing it. And I like you say, we want him back next week. But we'll get him back sooner than later. We'll definitely try to set something up. I think at this point is where we kind of leave it off to let everybody talk about it on the message boards and hopefully far and wide on the internet. And see where it goes from here.
Sounds good. Let me just ask you one more question. Now, I thought that the policeman had video footage of these tall blondes in the field.
Yeah, well, I didn't even think to bring that up. I thought there were stills or something out there. I'll have to check with Colin. I'm going to email him tonight or tomorrow and just follow up. And we're going to be sending him a copy of the show to put on his website as well. I'll ask him about that, and I'll definitely post a follow-up for that.
Very nice. Well, Jeffrey Ritzman, it's been another fascinating episode.
Damned if it hasn't.
I thank you for your friendship, and I love you.
And I love you, Chair.
<Da-na-na-na. laughs>